in. Today is Monday, the 31st at 1:04 p.m. And I'd like to call the meeting to order. And present are Representative Wilson, Representative Herron, Representative Dick, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Foster, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Feige, myself, Co-Chair Seaton. And I wanted to remind everybody about their cell phones before we begin. And today we will have two overviews. The first will be the overview from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Water Quality Division, Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And we will take about an hour on that. And so if we have, if we still have questions, we'll stop at that point, and then we will take our second overview, which is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And then we will do the Division of Water Quality. So Division of Spill Prevention and Response first, and then Water Quality second. We'll take them for the second hour, and if we get done early, we'll come back if people have additional questions. So with that, is there anything from the committee before we start? Nothing. Mr. Dietrich, would you like to come forward and present? And please put yourself on the record and proceed. And before you start, we have been joined by Representative Gardner as well.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
And you may go ahead and proceed. Larry, as you proceed, do you want to go through your presentation for questions, or do you want to have questions as you go through, if they're fairly short?
It's a pleasure of the committee, as long as I can get through it. There's slides, but there's a lot of images, and but either way, it's okay as long as I get her done.
Okay, maybe what we'll do is we will go through, if there's substantive questions, would you hold those to the end, just an explanation on what's been said, or then we'll take them at that time. But for, you know, going down rabbit trails, we'll wait till the end. Go ahead and proceed.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank the co-chairs and the committee. We haven't done overviews for a while, and it's a good opportunity, and hope we've done a good job here giving you a high-level overview of what the Spill Prevention Response Division does. So with that in mind, we do have a presentation here, and I understand you all can view it there. So this is the beginning slide. This is the homepage for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And let's see. Here's the mission of the division, is to protect public health and the environment through prevention, preparedness, and response to oil and hazardous substance releases. And that's our overall mission. Our goals, again, are to prevent spills, prepare for when spills do occur, and then to actually respond when they happen. And that's to both oil and hazardous substances. Anywhere in the state of Alaska. Our fourth primary objective then is to manage the response fund, which is our primary funding source to run the division operations. Organizationally, this is our organizational structure. There's one director, and we execute these goals through four programs. Our first one is the Prevention Emergency Response Program. And we have a industry preparedness program, which oversees industry readiness for spill response in Alaska. And then we have a contaminated site program, which does all the remedial cleanups. And then we have an administrative group that manages our response fund activities. I'll go through this during the presentation here. We'll go through program by program. This next slide gives you a little bit about the qualifications of the people in our division, the people that are running the division. The senior leadership includes myself, and then we have four program managers. I got kind of scared the other day when I asked them to tally up the years of experience. It came out to be 156 years. Divided by five, that was 31. We have a couple people probably getting close to doing retirement, but we have a very senior team, I guess is the point there. We have very diverse backgrounds, as you can see, educationally by the degree, various degrees that our folks on our senior leadership have, including city manager experience. We've got Coast Guard experience. It's quite an array. So we got a very good senior leadership team that's got a lot of experience in the state for a very long time, very familiar with what we do. Our job classes are the traditional state job classes for environmental specialists, environmental engineers, environmental technicians, and then high school and college interns. The first program we'll go through is the Prevention and Emergency Response Program. These are the guys that respond to spills. Their mission is to protect public health and environment by preventing and mitigating the effects of oil and hazardous substance releases and ensuring their cleanup through government planning and rapid response. Here's next slide. Gives you an idea of the number of spills we experienced in Alaska back to 95, which is when we went on to an electronic database. The shaded background there is the average over the period of time, so we're somewhere around 2,200 spills, a little above 2,200 spills reported per year. The line part of the graph is the actual number reported on a given year, and you can see in 2010 we were down to about 1,700, I think, in 84 spills was the count. There's not a great change over time, but that gives you an idea that of the number of spills we deal with on an annual basis.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, what exactly constitutes the minimum spill? It seems like an awful lot, but I'm sure it's not just large discharges.
Yeah, Co-Chair, yeah, the spills under the Clean Water Act, any spill of oil or hazardous substance has to be reported. In Alaska, it's graduated. So if it's to land and if it's 0 to 10 gallons, then there's a delayed time frame for reporting. But for hazardous substance, it's any amount that may cause a threat. So to get the amount for hazardous substance, it just depends on the volume and the circumstances in the receiving environment.
Representative Kawasaki and then Gardner.
I have never seen a graph like this, just indicating sort of the total number of spills. I would have expected, though, that there would have been more spills over time, just because, I mean, you hear about them quite a bit more, I do anyways, and there's aging infrastructure, so you hear about those type of spills. I guess, why can you account for the trend downward? Is there less enforcement? Is there less inspections or are there more inspections to prevent the spills from actually occurring? I guess, how would you quantify this?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I would like to think that some of the spill prevention programs are coming into play here, and I have some slides later that will show you the breakout between spills from the regulated community versus the unregulated community. It'll kind of give you a picture of that.
Right. Okay.
And Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, continuing on then, the Responsibilities Emergency Response Program then boil down to this. We actually have 24/7 response capability for emergency oil spill response. We do that through three teams. We do the same for response to hazardous substances, or HAZMAT as it's generally referred to, again, anywhere in the state. There's a big component that works with drills and exercises. We prepare all the government oil spill response plans, and I've got a slide on that to show you the breakout of those. We've also developed agreements with local communities so we can use local resources and local knowledge and incorporate them into the state spill response. And then we're also the key player in disaster response coordination. When we do have a disaster, we handle the environmental functions that are associated with that disaster. These are our three response teams. We have one for Northern Alaska, South Central, and Southeast. They're based in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. This is an interesting slide. This is the statewide HAZMAT work group, which we initiated in 1997. The state made a decision as to whether or not the state was going to develop a HAZMAT capability, what they call a Level A capability. A Level A capability, as you know, is kind of the moon suit. It's a fully encapsulated response with self-contained breathing apparatus. So it's for a worst case, like an ammonia gas or a chlorine gas type of thing. State opted not to develop that capability. You need about 25 people to have a 24/7 capability like that with intensive training. It's very specialized. So we embarked with the two organizations in the state to try to use their existing capability, and that was Anchorage and Fairbanks at the time, with their fire service districts, because they had enough size to them that they could afford to do that. And it took about 2 years to work out an agreement with those two key municipalities whereby their hazmat capability would respond outside of their jurisdiction, working for our state on-scene coordinator to respond to a hazmat event at the direction of the state. And the agreement basically provides then that we reimburse the local community, and the agreement also deals with the workman comp's liability issues. And that was the beginning for developing the statewide hazmat capability. And as you can see, we've evolved now. We've brought in 25 different organizations statewide, including the military, WMD. And so the state has a fairly formidable hazmat capability in play now that is contributed to by all of these different organizations. Ketchikan and Juneau are the two most recent municipalities to go down this path. This slide summarizes the government planning that goes on. There are federal plans that have to be followed up in the upper left corner. There's a national contingency plan, regional contingency plan, area contingency plans. The state has also passed statutes on the right, upper right, and they're called a state master plan, a regional master plans, and this is all for oil to guide oil and hazardous substance response. We've taken the state and federal plans all come together in a single plan for the state of Alaska called the Unified Plan, and then it has sub-area plans, and the idea of unifying those plans is they meet both state and federal requirements and allows us to have a single plan then for Alaska. That's coupled with local plans then, and then industry has their own separate requirements for oil spill plannings if you're regulated.
Okay, Ms. Dietrich, yeah. On the plans that we heard about in the Gulf of Mexico that included walruses, do we have plans that are more definitive than that, or do they include manatees? I mean, are these kind of cookie-cutter worldwide plan, or have they been more specifically developed for Alaska?
Co-Chair Seaton, plans in the Gulf, there was an error made. Part of the plan requires you to identify environmentally sensitive areas and species. And so those are identified in the industry plans up here and in the government plans that go with them. And down there, I think there was just an error there. They extrapolated from some other plans on the books and ended up with some northern species in the southern plan. The identification beyond that, though, is otherwise a standard thing that is required.
So, clarification then, the plans that we have here are very specific to Alaska?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. This next slide shows the local response agreements that I just mentioned about. We have agreements in place with 43 communities now around the state, and then we work with those communities for training, and then we try to meet their equipment needs in locations where they don't have a regulated facility that perhaps has spill response equipment, and then we try to backfill that with what is needed for whatever the spill threat is for that community. And so there's a series of connexes then that we place in those communities where we have an agreement so that when something happens, we can call them up, and then they can act at the direction of our state on-scene coordinator, do an immediate response until we bring in reinforcements. Prevention emergency response activities, here gives you a snapshot of the kind of work they do over the course of the year. There's about 1,740 reported spills last year. We did about 684 responses on that. 24 of them were significant. There's 25 oil spill drills and exercises. We also completed what we call a statewide hazardous materials commodity flow study. So we actually inventory all the commodities flowing through the state that is either a hazardous substance or extremely hazardous substance, and we do that by all transportation modes, rail, vessel, highway, and air. That information then is fed into the statewide hazmat group, and so we've identified the major hazmat risks in Alaska, which are chlorine and ammonia in our rural communities, ammonia used for refrigeration. Chlorine is a declining risk because most communities are converting over to getting off chlorine gas and going to liquid chlorine now, so we don't have this gas cloud problem. But the commodity flow study tells us exactly what we're transporting around the state, and it tells those teams exactly what to gear up for then if we have a spill.
When he's finished with this.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, just last 2 points. We also update the plans, have to be updated on a frequency, so we complete those. And then we're also doing vessel risk assessments for Cook Inlet and Aleutians, and I'll expand on that a little bit later.
Okay, thank you. Representative Herron.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You have in your files here, it says you have 8 active responses, 1 in this year, 4 last year, and then a couple is in 07. Why are the oldest ones still active?
Through the chair, I would have to check on which one those were, but we could provide you an update on those. Some of those, if the cleanups are not completed at the time, they have a remediation component they might extend on for additional time frames.
Yeah, the one is Acres Quick Trip and then Sandpoint Abandoned. And just a quick follow-up is it says on the website here that the pump booster piping incident is final and has a red star by it. What does that mean?
Again, through the chair, the red star, I think, is an indicator of new information being entered, if that's off the website. The one other example you mentioned there, the Acres, is a situation in Valdez with groundwater contamination from a gasoline release, and those take years. Longer to bring to completion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great.
Hiroshima was an event to show you a couple of illustrations here that the regulations, the development of the program over time has been event-driven. So I'll give you a couple slides on some of the things that have driven the expansion of the laws in Alaska through the legislature. And this is a non-tank vessel. This is a vessel over 400 gross tons, but it is not carrying oil as cargo. So it's essentially a freighter, but they do carry an immense amount of bunker. And we had a number of incidents. Kirishima was one. The Selendang was another, and that led to the regulation of non-tank vessels in 2001. Winter cleanup, we spent a lot of time on that. This just shows you some of the rope mops in play. The one on the right is a Cook Inlet mop done by a Cook Inlet Spill Prevention Inc., CISPRI, our co-op, and the other is a slotted ice technique that's used for winter cleanups. Here's a railroad transfer going on here. It's typical if we have a tank car incident, getting the fuel off the damaged car is usually the first priority business. This is a shot of the GC2 spill. It's 2006. Again, it was a crude oil spill. And this is a pipe rack here, so you can see some of the difficulties of getting in to the area here to do the cleanups. This is a shot of a forward-looking infrared, and this is how you see where the oil is during winter conditions. You can see the delineation of it using this technique is very good. So when you can't otherwise see through the snow to know where it's going, this is a technique that's used to allow us to design the cleanup approach.
And Representative Feige.
Just for everybody in the committee, I was flying that mission, took that picture.
Really?
Really? That's your picture?
Well, I was in front of the airplane. The floor operator was in the back.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And we got the call. It was a Sunday morning. The phone rang at 5:30. The airplane was out of the hangar in 30 minutes. We had to mount the ball on the airplane. But just please continue.
Congratulations. This picture here, I'm not sure if I should ask Representative Feige or yourself, but is this a heat signature or is this a material signature? I mean, are we able to identify this because of heat, or is it actually we're able to see it because of the difference in material that's there, even if it has gotten to ambient temperature?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah, this is a temperature differential.
Okay.
The last thing then this program does, disaster coordination, the Eagle, the breakup with Eagle there, where there was a lot of hazmats and oil spills involved with that. So we were one part of a much larger state cleanup there, and that's just to illustrate our involvement in that. Industry preparedness is this next program now. Their mission is to protect public health and environment by ensuring that the producers, transporters, and distributors of crude oil and refined oil products prevent oil spills and are prepared materially and financially to respond and clean up spills. So this is the group that oversees that part of industry that is regulated under state law. This shot gives you a picture of the whole infrastructure. The top half, the shaded area, is the crude oil infrastructure and consists of oil wells, production facilities, crude oil transmission pipelines such as TAPS that delivers it to the terminal, and then crude oil storage tanks, and then obviously crude oil tankers. In the middle there, bridging between the two, are refineries. And then for refined product, you also have non-crude oil terminals that store that product. And then the other users of non-crude oil that are regulated include vessels and barges, the railroad, which is also regulated in this state and has to have a contingency plan, non-tank vessels, which are those vessels over 400 gross tons, and then certain underground storage tanks. The components that are in the circle, the dashed circle, then are those other parts of the infrastructure in the state that are not regulated. This is how we go about if you're regulated. It gets pretty detailed and pretty technical as to how, if you are part of the regulated industry that are subject to some of the spill prevention requirements, the facility structures are actually broken down, and they get pretty specific as to what's regulated for what purpose, and they have very specific industry standards and stuff then that must be followed. And this just shows you a schematic how this is broke out. The green lines, for example, are the flow lines that carry three-phase oil from drill sites to a production facility. The red pipelines are pipelines that carry sales spec crude oil from a production facility, then either to storage or down taps and to the terminals. I won't go into all the details. This, I just wanted to kind of use it to illustrate how the different regulatory requirements are very much targeted to very specific components because of the nature of these facilities, which are fairly sophisticated.
And would you just define for the committee three-phase?
Three-phase is oil, gas, and water, which is what comes out of the ground from the well before those things are separated out of production facility.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kawasaki, you had a question?
Yeah, I don't know if it's part of your presentation. I didn't see a slide on it, but I hope that the committee might be able to take just the oil spill preparedness question up at some point in time, just because of the aging infrastructure we've heard of, you know, the crude spill with the Alyeska pipeline, and just sort of how you've resolved. I know you guys did a great job to get that under control in 2 days, but I'd like to hear kind of the future, what the next step is as far as your agency goes.
Yeah, and if that's not part of the presentation, that'll be our kind of our first question,
sure,
a general question, okay, more specific at the end.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. I will touch on that at the end here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Herron?
On the next slide,
okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Here for the next slide. Here's the breakout I mentioned before. If you want to see the split in those numbers, spill reports reported annually, this is how it breaks out. So 73% of the number of spills is coming from the unregulated community. About 27% is coming from those that part of the community that's regulated.
So the unregulated community would be non-monitored vessels under 400 tons that aren't bulk carriers and those kind of things, or domestic fuel tanks. Those are kind of the broader universe of
the things that are in the dashed circle there, Mr. Chairman, are is what would be considered the unregulated community.
Okay, thank you. And then Representative Wilson has a question, and then Gert.
If most of our problem comes from the unregulated part of the state or whatever, and I guess what I'm wanting to know is, of course, none of us want regulations or anything, but when, like, if I had a leak in my gas tank, fuel oil tank, or something like that, do we have to call you, or do I call my regular guy that delivers my oil and he calls you, or what? How do you find out about it?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we find out, we may get a spill report, we may get a phone call. It comes in a variety of different ways as to how it might be brought to our attention. The owner, under state law, would be required to take care and do the cleanup, but your tank and your facility is otherwise not regulated in terms of how it's installed, or not, at least not by us. I don't know if fire service might have some requirements there, but your fuel tank itself and the lines are not a regulated entity under our rules.
And I can tell you it doesn't always happen, but you're not supposed to call your representative. But I can tell you from personal experience that it often happens. Representative Gardner and Representative Munoz.
Thank you. And just briefly on the pie chart of the regulated and unregulated, that's in the number of spills. What would that pie chart look like if you were illustrating the volume of spill?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we can get you that.
Okay. But I'm assuming it would look very different.
Yes. You have to be careful with the assumptions when you draw from this, because you actually have to tease this apart, and you have to look at the volume, you have to look at the type of the facility, and in some cases location of the state, uh-huh, to really start digesting what this means. So this is, again, a high-level representation of what's going on.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Do you have statutory responsibility in the unregulated instances to respond, and how is it different, your response to the regulated responses?
Representative Munoz, the basic statutory requirements, if you have a spill, you got to clean it up, okay? And so that's your requirement. If you have a spill, you got to remove the material and take care of whatever's necessary to do that. You are not otherwise regulated in terms of your tanks or facilities are subject to certain prevention or operational requirements as to how you operate your facility. So like residential, we don't regulate home heating fuel tanks. But if you're a production or a flow line in a pipeline field, then you are regulated, and there's pipeline integrity and corrosion and all kinds of things then that you would have to meet.
Can they, and Representative Perrin has a question.
Yes, this is on slide number 26 that's up. Is the goal of SPAR is making industry and government's ability to prepare and respond to spills, quote unquote, better. Why? What's the difference between quote unquote better and then best available technology?
Through the chair, there is a requirement for regulated facilities to use best available technology. And so if you are an operator, you have to, as part of your oil spill contingency plans, meet best available technology in the preparation of that plan and make that demonstration to the department. If you're otherwise not regulated, then there is no requirement imposed.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
In the goal, it says you want to make things better. What does better mean?
Well, better, I'm not sure, again, through the chair, better, what we're looking for better is better operation with fewer spills. I mean, that's our goal is overall is to reduce the number and severity of spills, and to us that's how we would define better. Whether you're regulated or not regulated, I mean, that's our overall goal is to cut down a total number of spills as well as their severity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This then captures the main key things with the industry preparedness programs. They review the industry plans. They also do spill drills, inspections. This group ensures that each regulated entity has a financial responsibility to respond to a spill. They register all of our primary response action contractors in the state, and they do the reviews of best available technology. Drills is just an example of the drills. The state has some very large drills, usually on the North Slope and Prince William Sound, as well as all other areas of the state. These are our spill cooperatives. These are the organizations in the state that have evolved from the state law that actually conduct the responses on behalf of the regulated community. There's Alaska Clean Seas on the North Slope. There's Cook Inlet Spill Prevention Response, Inc., which covers Cook Inlet. There's Southeast Alaska Petroleum Response Organization that covers Southeast, Alaska Pipeline Ship Escort Response Vessel System, which covers Prince William Sound, and then Shadoo Corporation, which pretty much covers all the other areas of the state, a lot of them in Aleutians and Northwest Alaska. The other resource we have is SUPSALV. The DOD has some response capability for military vessels. Prevention is a big thing. This is the Overseas Ohio. This is a mid-90 incident. This is a crude oil tanker in Prince William Sound that hit ice after the 1989 event, and it shows you the potential risks that we still really have out there. This almost hit the collision bulkhead, which is right at the end of the bulbous nose here, which would have then, had that been penetrated, then there would have been another release because you're right into a cargo tank. So it's a reminder that we need to be vigilant. This is the current escort system we've got in Prince William Sound, which double tug escort was just made mandatory under federal law. That's a typical hookup for going through the narrows. Here's some statistics on what this program does in terms of number of contingency plan actions, inspections, exercises, underground storage tank repairs that have been done. The spills analysis is a recently completed study that we did on the oil infrastructure on the North Slope, which identified where the high risks are. And then we also have a component going on right now to learn all we can from the Deepwater Horizon spill. Somebody mentioned the Pump Station 1 bypass. These are photos from that bypass being installed from the recent event. They had to restart the pipe through the corroded pipe to get a couple pigs unstuck. And the permanent repairs are now planned for this summer. Pipeline inspections, another thing to do, this is a crew doing some wall thickness testing on some pipe. It gets, again, it gets pretty sophisticated inspection and testing programs following API procedures. This is a drift river. This is another one of the threats you encounter. This was a non-spill, but it's the kind of situations like Pump 1, which really wasn't any kind of a significant spill, but it mobilizes the response community to stand up a command in anticipation of a spill occurring. This was a Lahar that went right around the Drift River Terminal. Never actually really interfered with the terminal, but you can see it was a close call. This is an example of a pipeline break on the North Slope. This is the Lisburn. Third program, contaminated sites. This particular operation here, they're removing some PCB-contaminated soils. An old FAA site where we had transformers leak that used to use oil with PCBs. Not an uncommon thing in Alaska. Their mission is on the remediation side to protect public and the environment by identifying and overseeing conducting the cleanup, redevelopment, and management of all the contaminated sites in Alaska. Most of our contaminated sites in Alaska are legacy sites, what we call legacy sites, by far. We're not adding many new contaminated sites, and that's a very good thing because the cleanups in this day and age are robust. We take them to completion, and we don't have this residual contamination that really goes all the way back to World War II. We're still dealing, the DOD cleanups in the state are a very big component of contaminated site cleanup. This graph didn't come out right. The colors didn't come through, but this simply reflects the number of sites closed versus the number of known open sites. And I believe in your package you've got the colored version. If for some reason it didn't copy over on the stick. And that's just to give you a feel for the number of sites that this program is dealing with and the number that had been closed out to date. Of all the contaminated sites we have, this gives you the breakout. Most of them are petroleum, 83%. 17% are other chemicals. Exposure pathways is the way these sites are managed, so whether it's inhalation, dermal exposure, or ingestion, and we manage these sites to break the pathway so that people are not exposed, and you, by breaking those pathways, then the risk is reduced, and we use that as one of the key tools in figuring out how to conduct cleanup. This slide here on the risk continuum gives you a feel for how where the bulk of the sites are in. Starting from the bottom to the top, you can see that there are many sites that just kind of generally pose a risk to natural resources. But then as you go up the scale, we encounter sites that are chronological risk or chronic ecological risk, other sites that pose a chronic public health risk, or at the top of the scale, those that pose either acute risk to either ecological resources or public health. And those get the highest attention and usually an immediate response. The other ones are in the remediation phase. This is just a pie chart showing the approximate proportion by hazard ranking. Contaminated sites, This group manages all the contaminated sites in the state, and they're usually breaking out by state, federal sites, private sites. We do area-wide cleanups where contamination exceeds the property boundary. We have a very active reuse redevelopment program where contaminated sites can be put back into the marketplace and reused. All of our sites are risk-based cleanups, and we also establish and maintain the cleanup standards that are used. Here's the site ownership, and if you look at both the federal civilian and the federal military sites, they compose half the contaminated sites inventory that we deal with are in the federal government domain. This is a site operation down on the Kenai, an old refinery site where they're capturing hydrocarbons that have basically come from the refinery site. We're leaking down into Cook Inlet, and this is an interception trench and a remedial device then to capture those and deal with them. These are the activities carried out by the program, usually on an annual basis. Give you kind of a picture. There's about 837 sites a year that we are dealing with some element of assessment, monitoring, or cleanup. There was 135 sites last year where risk reduction measures were implemented. We had 70 new site assessments and risk evaluations performed. 19 of the sites went through the brownfield assessment and cleanup program. We've got a number of very wide groundwater investigations going on, most of them in the interior. And we've got some targeted assessments going of chlorinated solvents, again, in the interior. It's typical what they run into. This is an old drum site, and you run into these across the state, and you like to get to these old drum collections that have been staged around before they start leaking and making a mess. They get to be problematic because you have to characterize the contents of each one of those when you run into it, so it gets to be quite a bit of work involved. This shows you an area-wide contamination. So you see the plume. This is actually in downtown Fairbanks there, and how the plume underlines a great number of properties. This is a chlorinated solvent plume that we're dealing with.
We had Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. The abandoned drums, like how many different groupings of a bunch of drums, those barrels are just sitting out there waiting for you to come in and discover them? Are there a lot of them across the state, you know, like 30, or is there like 500?
Chair, I'd like to say we found them all, but every time I say that, they find somebody reports another cache. The North Slope, I think, has been swept pretty clean. We still have some problems down towards the Aleutians in the Bristol Bay area. Certainly the historic drum collections have all been identified, and great progress has been made to clean them up. And there are fewer newer ones come along, but it's not a problem that's totally eradicated yet. Okay. This other site, this is a bunker site. This is another legacy site. It's an old bunker tank. This was actually in Fairbanks here, and that cleanup has been done now. That's another from yesteryear. This is a oil-contaminated land farm on the North Slope put together by the companies up there to actually farm oil-contaminated soils as a treatment method. This takes us to our last group, last program, our Response Fund Administration Group. And their job is to manage and administer the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention Response Fund as a sustainable funding source for the state's core spill prevention response program. And they get involved, they manage the response fund, we recover our costs, they do our contract management, they act as a finance section during our emergency response, they prepare the biennial response fund report for the legislature, and they also manage our information technology folks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, you've got an area here where it's cost recovery. Mm-hmm. Can you usually come out even with that, or do you have to continually ask for extra money from the state? How does that work?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. We have, as you know, the spiller pays. So any costs that are incurred by the state for responding to a spill are billed to the responsible party, And our cost recovery rate is pretty good. I think after this slide, I've got some numbers there to show you. It depends on the nature of it. It's hard to average out. You have to average it almost on a three-year basis because sometimes an event happens, but the cost recovery may not happen for a year or two down the road. So you have to kind of average it to see on a fiscal year. But we're probably doing better than 90% cost recovery.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The slide that shows site ownership, it was quite a few back, just showing 37% federal, 33% private. Does that pretty much sync up with the cost producer is also the cost payer then?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, yes. On the federal side, we do cost recovery. Matter of fact, because they're a government entity, we have a large number of agreements in place through DOD primarily where we negotiate what the cost will be for taking the next step of cleanup at the federal military sites ahead of time so that the federal agency can insert it in their budget cycle and get the funding, which they then use to reimburse the state for the oversight costs.
Great.
Okay. This is the response fund. I won't go into it, but basically the left side is the response account fueled by the 1 cent surcharge. The right side is the prevention account, which serves as their operating money, which is fueled by the 4 cent surcharge. We actually have a brown bag presentation just on this that we did last year for the legislature, and if anybody wants to get into details of this, we'd be glad to do that. Otherwise, it's got a lot of complexities to it that are beyond the amount of time here we can really use to get into it. Here's some of the numbers here. There's $2.3 million recovered from 973 responsible parties in the last year. There's the volumes of money for managing our state contracts, our reimbursable service agreements, $5.7 million in 23 federal grants, and $2.8 million in cost recovery for significant spill response. So that just gives you kind of a snapshot of some of their activities here. Here's the declining balance situation here. This is a crude oil production graph. I'm sure you've seen this. And the surcharge is based on production, not price per barrel. So when the flow goes down, our revenue is reduced. Not compensated by an increase in price per barrel, unlike the general fund. Initiatives, this is the last here. We did do a North Slope spills analysis on the aging infrastructure, flow lines. Were identified as posing the greatest risk. We are now taking measures to implement some new measures for those flow lines. We've also developed an emergency towing system, which I'll show you an example of in a minute. Shipping is getting a lot of our attention right now. We have an Aleutians Marine Vessel Risk Assessment underway, a Cook Inlet Marine Vessel Risk Assessment that is just getting started, and there's a lot of concern about Arctic shipping, as well as we're working on the Deepwater Horizons lessons learned as the reports come out. This is slide shows the towing system, which I think we're really proud of. One of the things coming out of the Celandang IU that was a shortcoming is there's no tow lines on the vessels in the circumpolar traffic, which is a large number of vessels per year. And so a number of years ago, we identified getting a tow line that was light and flexible as a key response tool. This is the first time the tow line, since it was procured by the state, and it's a collaborative effort with the mayor in Unalaska, with Coast Guard, Marine pilots, vessel owners, and others. And so the line was deployed for the Golden Seas, which lost power this year and was towed back. So the left slide is towing by the Tor Viking, which is the vessel or a tug that was in Unalaska at the time that was brought there by Shell, coupled with the new towing line, allowed this vessel, which had mechanical difficulties, to be towed almost from ADAC all the way up to Alaska. I think it was something like 400 miles with this new line, and we count that as a save, and so that was fairly significant.
Mr. Diedrich, that tow line, is that staged in Alaska, and then if there's a vessel available, they put it on it, or how is the availability of that line for ships that are 400 miles away? How do you work that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We pre-positioned the first kit in Alaska, and there's both a tow line for over 50,000 deadweight tons, and I believe one for under, and we work with the Coast Guard, so one is air deployable through their helicopter, and the other can be used with a vessel for vessel-to-vessel deployment or helicopter-to-vessel type deployment. And we think we need to We're going to pre-position one in Kodiak and probably in Sitka. This kind of gives you an idea here. The circumpolar route, all that traffic on the top thing goes through Unimak Pass. So if you're anything from the Pacific Rim coming over to the U.S. north of San Francisco ports, goes through Unimak Pass, and it's quite a large volume of ships. And that towing line is a key piece now that hopefully we can tag onto these. This is the other shipping issue that's coming up. You can see the northern route, which goes across the top of Canada, or the northern sea route, which goes across the Russian coastline, excuse me, and then the Northwest Passage, which goes along Canada. But they all come down through the Bering Straits. And if this ever opens up, then the Bering Straits is a constriction, and so that's an area of concern. And so there's some studies now on the risks associated with shipping through there that are being initiated. Last but not least is the Deepwater Horizons. We've participated in a nationwide review of that, and there's a number of lessons to be learned for Alaska that we're pulling together out of that. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Larry. Representative Gardner, let's see. We did have one question that was on the table first before we get into, and I believe that was Representative Kawasaki. Did you pose that question on the TAP? Did you get on
yes.
pump station number one? Did you get that yeah. adequately answered? Or
not really.
Okay. Larry, could you back up onto that issue on pump station number one? And give us a little more detail on that.
Yes, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I think we're talking about the recent event. It basically there was a there's a section of pipe comes out of a boosher pump table. It is encased in concrete that's not accessible by pigging. And it had been pre-identified by Alyeska for repair. And it was a corrosion issue, but it apparently penetrated through before the scheduled repair this summer. And so there was seepage occurring there. They shut in the pipeline as a result. The oil that did seep went into the containment structure within the manifold building, so none escaped the environment. There may be some that got into the gravels, and that's being assessed, but no significant amount that's been detected. So Alyeska needed at that time then to it was shut down. It was shut down, I think it was approximately 80 hours. There were two pigs in the line when it was shut down, and it became urgent that those pigs, so as not to be froze in, that warm oil go down the pipe. And so it was a question of whether or not to restart by going through the damaged pipe or wait for the bypass, which required some fabrication. That's what you see here, which takes a longer period of time. And so the command had to deal with the decision of whether or not to go through that damaged pipe or wait an additional amount of time with unknown, potentially irreversible consequences to the system, including shut-in of wells, supply of feedstocks for four different in-state refineries. So very big potential consequences. So the decision was made to restart through the damaged pipe. They flowed oil down through there. Those pigs were vetted out of the system. Then it was shut down again for the second startup, which was then done to allow this bypass work to be completed. And now then there was a restart, and they're back up. I don't know if they're quite at the previous production yet, but they're working their way up there. And then a permanent repair will be done this summer where they will take the original damaged pipe that's in the hardened concrete and they'll totally remove that and replace it with an above ground pipe.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Larry. This might be more of a question for Alyeska, but I'm just curious if there's other – I guess my concern was that they weren't able to pig portions that are encased in concrete. If there's other portions across the state that are like that, if it's something that – regular maintenance would be taken care of, or something that that your division needs to look into as far as future regulations. I guess we want to make sure that pipeline's stable. We don't have sort of that shutdown. It only cost us $300 million or something for the 142 hours it was shut down. But I think that more importantly, it's sort of the danger of having something worse happen down the road.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I think we would agree, yeah. I mean, there's changing conditions that are going on with the composition of the oil, and I think it's a very dynamic situation, and companies, first and foremost, as operators of these things, have very sophisticated, aggressive programs, and I think they're going to have to get more aggressive and more sophisticated to stay on top and anticipate the changing conditions. And those are increased sediment and lowering temperatures that come from low flow. So it's definitely something to keep, have to be very vigilant about that. And, efforts probably need to be increased.
So just for explanation, any other sections that are similar to that were connection lines or something that couldn't be pigged, those are probably on an accelerated maintenance schedule now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And again, this problem had been identified. It's just the rate of corrosion was forecasted to be a little bit longer, that it had a longer life, but it didn't quite make it. So it caught them early. So those things have to be tightened up now, I believe. Plus, they're fixing this because it wasn't concrete and not accessible. So you couldn't get your normal UT measuring in there because of it being encased in concrete, and that's just a function of the original design. So those things that were originally designed such a matter, when they do this replacement, they will have full access into the pipe after this to do the complete suite of testing they would otherwise be able to do.
Okay. We have Representative Gardner and Representative Feige.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your presentation. On the slide number 51, entitled North Slope Contaminated Soil Land Farm, and you said this was a treatment method. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, Representative Gardner, through the chair. This is where you windrow and till it out, and you let the air, let the aerobic oxidation of feed the bugs that are in the soil to metabolize and break down the hydrocarbons. And so it's windrowed, as you can see here, the contaminated soils. And this is an actual treatment method then that can be used.
The chair.
Follow up, Representative
Thank
Gardner.
You. So this wasn't like an experimental process here, but rather one way they chose to address an accidental spill?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, yeah, they use this, I think, for economic efficiency so that petroleum-contaminated soils are removed from small spills around the slope. They have a facility there permanently there where they can take care of this material. This is a conventional way of doing it. This isn't experimental.
Thank you. And through the chair, so is there any follow-up to measure the effectiveness?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, yeah, this is all completely monitored, and they will check for soil cleanup levels to be attained, and when they hit certain soil cleanup levels, then it will be deemed completely treated and released, and then they can reuse the soil for other purposes.
Thank you.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 13, the local spill response agreement and equipment is the map of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And the legend there, you've got various type of packages and sites and who owns them and whatnot. The on the North Slope, as I recall, there are a certain number of non-state-owned response equipment containers. Just about every river and creek and in that area has got some kind of a connex that I understand is filled with spill response equipment, including booms and whatnot. Is that just Does that somehow not fit under the legend, or is it just omitted for clarity?
Yes, Co-Chair Feige, this does not include the industry gear,
okay,
which is probably perhaps what you're referring to. So on the North Slope, this is simply what we're providing with those communities. We have local agreements to fill holes and gaps. The industry gear and connexes that they have available around the state is not on this graph, and it is substantial. Neither is the gear that's represented by the spill co-ops.
Okay. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, Alaska is going to host the next Clean Pacific Conference, and apparently that's going to be in September.
Representative Herron, through the chair, the next Clean Pacific will not be till a year after this. That's sponsored by the Pacific States BC Oil Spill Task Force. And the big oil spill conference this year is the International Oil Spill Conference, which will be in Portland. I think it's in May. And so the Clean Pacific Conference goes on a rotating year, so it'll be the year after. The Pacific States Oil Spill Task Force will otherwise have their annual meeting here in Alaska on August 24th.
So, Mr. Chairman, Larry, so I'm assuming that Arctic shipping and the transboundary agreements we have with British Columbia will, that those will be big discussions at these conferences, both in Portland and in Alaska. I mean, are we going to expand our transboundary agreements to the territories on the Arctic?
Representative Herron, that's a good question. We currently have transboundary agreements with Canada on the south end, Ketchikan, and we're developing one on the north end and had a drill with them in that regard this year. And those, we continue to work with the Canadians to fine-tune those and intermesh different command systems and those kinds of things to be ready for any event on those two transboundary areas for Alaska. There's nothing otherwise in the work for the other side of the international border from a state perspective. We would like to see it, but the Coast Guard is taking steps now to work with the Russians, I believe, and develop. They have liaisons already there through the fisheries programs and whatnot, and the Arctic shipping and oil spill response coordination, we look to them to take the lead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. And Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, first of all, commend your division for the good work that you do. I worked in industry for nearly 10 years, and we always had a good relationship with the division, and I thought that they always tried to work with us and trying to steer us in the right direction and make sure that we're doing a good job. Question I have is regarding unreported spills. Are you seeing many instances where an at-fault party does not report a spill, especially like the smaller spills, 50 gallons or 100 gallons, but then you get a third party that comes in and maybe reports that? And then I'm curious as to whether you think that the the consequences of not reporting and then somebody get caught, are those good enough deterrents? Just your general thoughts on that.
Yes, Representative Foster, through the chair. Well, first of all, I think my first comment would be the entities in the state that are regulated, it would be my opinion they do a very good job reporting. I think industry should be commended. They're very much on top of it, and I don't think that we're experiencing much underreporting from the regulated entities in the state. To the extent we do have underreporting, which I believe we do, I believe it is coming from the unregulated communities, and it is probably the smaller operators, and we hear a lot of complaints, sadly enough, about fishing vessels and other unregulated components. I mean, home heating fuel tanks, and there are a number of tank farms that are below our threshold for regulation, where spills are not always tediously reported. So the extent of that, I don't know if we know for sure, but I think it's also not as big a deal as what it used to be. And we used to have major problems with spill reporting with regulated industry. And I would say in the last two decades, we've got a very responsible industry in this state now. So it's mostly that unregulated category where that would be happening, I believe.
Yeah, follow up.
Follow-up, Representative Foster.
Thank you. And maybe from my standpoint, not focusing, I shouldn't have focused on the deterrence part, but also on just helping to prevent. What are some of the tools out there that you use to help folks to, maybe not just prevent, but encouraging them to report so that the correct measures can be taken?
Again, Representative Foster, through the chair, the kinds of things we do to try, where we do think we have a reporting or spills issue, we try to target what that source is, and then since if it's not a regulated source, which it's not, then we try to create an educational type approach. For example, we have a number of spills from home heating fuel tanks. It's not atypical. So we've actually targeted home heating fuel tanks, and we have a design document now on how to build and construct them and keep them from tipping over and how to put overhangs on them. So we do outreach. We've had public service announcements on that. And every year we go out with that to try to get property owners to make sure you check your tanks so that we avoid spills. We also have another initiative for clean harbors, for work with Lynn Kent's Division of Water and others to try to encourage spill reporting and bilge pump outs and those kinds of things, because that's kind of the next problem, another problem area that we identified. So we try to use technical assistance and education and outreach to try to educate folks to do a better job.
Thank you.
And we had one more, and then what we're going to do is let you go, and we'll bring you, you'll be here, I think, through the end of the testimony.
Yes.
All right. So we'll, if we have time, we'll bring you back up. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give us, not today, but unless this is going to be too complicated, and if it's too complicated, then don't do it. But can you give us the top five kinds of unregulated problems that pop up? Like, you know, to give us an idea, is it people with their home heating barrels that are is the biggest problem, and then it's, you know, the gas
commercial
station.
Fishermen.
Yeah.
Don't forget the commercial fishermen.
Yeah. Whatever, you know, whatever it is, that's the top five maybe, so that we have, we as legislators just have an idea in the unregulated area, what's the biggest area that is of concern.
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair, we could produce, I think, an information and get back to you in follow-up, and we can pull out the number of spills and the volume spilled by various sources and provide that to the committee.
Okay, thank
you.
I
appreciate that. If you, we'll make sure we get it to everybody. Okay, and thank you very much, and we will now take a very brief at ease while Ms. Kent gets set up here for the water quality debate.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. Mr. Horger, welcome, Ms. Kent. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your overview?
Great. Thank you, Co-Chairman Seaton and Co-Chair Feige and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Kent, and I'm the Director for the Water Division at the Department of Environmental Conservation. And we, too, have a lot of very old, I mean, very experienced staff in our division. but I might bring Director Dietrich's average down just a tiny bit. I think I've been with the department for about 25 years now. So a lot of experience in our department and in our division.
We collectively appreciate the wisdom that comes with that.
There we go.
And that was Representative Feige.
So it is the, oops, I better start punching buttons here. The mission at the Division of Water is to protect water quality and to assist communities in improving their sanitation conditions. And I sometimes find it easier to describe what we do in the Division of Water by exception. We do almost all things water except for regulation of public drinking water systems. And you heard from Commissioner Ryan, from Director Ryan Friday in our Environmental Health Division, and it's that division that regulates the public drinking water systems. And then we do not do water quantity or aquatic habitat issues. Those are housed with DNR and Fish and Game. Pretty much everything else is ours. I can see my slide is a little bit tiny there. We have two main components in our division, the facilities component and the water quality component. And then I have a small administrative group that works on budget issues and also manages our data systems. Now we'll go ahead and start with the facilities side of our division. There are 44 positions in this group.
And Ms. Kent, could you give us a follow-up slide on this division structure with the names of the personnel in those positions?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, moving over to the facilities programs. We have three programs there, the Municipal Grants and Loans Program, the Village Safe Water Program, the Operations Assistance Program, and our core services on the facility side are to provide funding and engineering assistance to communities of all sizes throughout the state for drinking water systems, sewage systems, and solid waste facilities. We provide training programs and certification of the water and sewer system operators. And then we also provide routine and emergency assistance to communities, rural communities, in the operation of their systems. So starting with the Municipal Grants and Loans Program and the grants portion of that, our Municipal Grants Program serve first and second class cities, home rule cities, organized boroughs, and eligible private utilities. The grants that we can provide for sewer and water systems are based on the percentage of the grant-funded portion of a project is based on the size of the community. So you'll see here that a community that has 10,000 or more people is eligible to receive 60% of a project to be funded through grants, and then the community has to meet a 40% match requirement. Smaller communities can receive a higher percentage for the grant portion of a project at 85%, and then they match that with 15%. So it's a kind of a sliding scale for eligibility in terms of the percentage of a project that can be funded by a grant.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this the program where that when they apply for this grant that it's kind of you kind of look ahead of time at the grants and there's numbers that you give the grantees so that then you pick from that which ones you're going to, because you don't have enough money to fund them all?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct. We do an annual solicitation for projects from the communities. Those are ranked and scored. Then we provide that information to the public, and in the end, those projects and communities end up in our annual budget request.
Thank you.
Let's see, eligible projects for grants, drinking water supply, treatment, distribution, and storage systems, wastewater collection, treatment, and discharge systems. We do fund some solid waste facility work and also some water quality enhancement projects.
And, Ms. Kent, the funding that you have available, does that vary from year to year, or is that kind of a formula driven for a certain set amount that you generally get?
Co-chair Seaton, it varies a little bit from year to year, but we haven't seen wild swings in that funding.
About what?
It's fairly stable.
Okay. And at about what level?
Oh, my gosh. I guess I'll have to get back to you on that. I didn't bring budget documents with me.
No, I just meant approximately whether it was, you know, $10 million or $20 million or $2 million or yeah. But you can get back to us on that. That'd be fine.
It's about 20. I'm sorry.
About 20. Okay. Thanks. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. The division also manages two loan funds, so we act a little bit like a bank. We have a clean water loan fund and a drinking water loan fund. Eligible projects under the Clean Water Fund are, again, wastewater facilities, so we can pay for the design for collection and treatment and discharge systems, solid waste facilities like landfill closures, landfill leachate collection and treatment systems, and water quality enhancement projects. The Drinking Water Loan Fund will cover drinking water systems, again, the design and construction of those facilities. And there are some private water systems that are eligible to receive loan funds from the department. Those are systems that are economically regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. As far as loans go, 100% of a project's eligible costs can be covered by a loan, unlike the grant program. And we find that a lot of communities will get a grant for a portion of the project, and then they will use the loan fund to meet the local match requirement. And that's allowed under the loan funds.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What kind of private water systems would be economically, what was the word you used?
economically regulated.
Regulated by the RCA?
Yes. Yes. Representative Gardner, through the chair. My understanding is that those are systems who their rate structure is overseen by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Are there private water systems, if I might, Mr. Chair,
Representative Gardner,
that aren't regulated by the RCA?
Yes, Representative Gardner. We actually refer to those as public water systems, but they may be smaller systems that might serve an apartment building or something like that that are not regulated.
Thank you.
Or not regulated by RCA. For our loan programs, there are no upfront fees. This is not like going in for your home mortgage where there's fees associated with initiating the loan. The communities can use the funds from the loan as their project proceeds. So, again, they don't have to receive the entire amount of the loan right up front, so they don't have to begin paying interest on a loan immediately when the loan is issued. It's as they use the loan. And the benefit to the communities is, of course, that the interest rates are very low.
And Lynn, is 100% of that loan fund utilized every year?
Representative Seaton, the drinking water loan fund is fully utilized right now. The clean water loan fund is not quite fully utilized. And when I say that, we have been using the loan fund, how do I describe this, much like a checking account. If there's not money in the loan fund, we aren't loaning it out. But a bank will do that. I'm not a banker. I don't use the correct terms. But a bank will actually loan out more money than they have available in their pocket. We're right now exploring ideas and methods for us to do a better cash flow management so that we can loan out more money.
And one other thing, this clean water fund, is that from federal clean water act funds or is this state funds?
Representative Seaton, both of the loan funds, original funding originated from federal grants, and we get an annual federal grant to help capitalize the loan funds, but they also consist of loan payments from previous loans that have been issued and interest on the fund themselves.
Thank you. Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you. Can you tell me approximately how many people or how many municipalities or whatever, how many of those don't get funded? In other words, there might be 506 that apply for a grant, but I'm talking about the grants, but I know you usually don't have enough to go around, so how many are left out? Because I know a few years ago that was increased quite a bit. And so even before it was increased, there wasn't enough to go around. And now, since it increased, I'd kind of like to know how many are getting left out and not being taken care of.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we can provide a list of the applicants for the grant funds and which ones were funded.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the next program is our Village Safe Water Program. A lot of you are familiar with that one. This group works with rural communities to develop their sustainable sanitation facilities. And in this program, we provide 100% grants to the community for planning, design, construction of the projects. And I know we're not a finance committee here, but our funding sources, this is primarily federal grants from Environmental Protection Agency and the USDA Rural Development Program with a 25% cost share from the state.
And Lynn, on the request for the number of applicants and the amounts and those that are serviced or not, could you just provide those and we'll make sure the whole committee gets hold of those?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Okay, eligible communities under the Village Safe Water Program are unincorporated communities that have between 25 and 600 people residing in kind of a core area of a two-mile radius is how we've defined that, second-class cities, and first-class cities that have fewer than 600 people. And in the Village Safe Water Program, we end up providing more assistance there than we would for the larger communities. So we provide financial, technical, and engineering assistance to the communities to plan, design, and construct their facilities. And again, it's similar types of sanitation facilities, drinking water systems, sewage collection, treatment, and disposal, washaterias in the villages sometimes, and solid waste management facilities. So current issues for the Village Safe Water Program, we have an ever-widening gap between what we have referred to as critical needs and available funding. Critical needs we define as those communities that don't have first-time drinking water or sewer systems and those who have infrastructure that is not meeting current regulatory requirements and may have a potential impact on human health.
So did I hear you say first time? So this is not renewals or maintenance. This is actually provision of the facilities first time in that community. Is that?
Yes, that we do have some communities that are not yet served.
Okay, thank you.
So that ever-increasing gap is in part due to decreasing federal funding for the program. And some of those remaining communities that have not been served yet are really the harder to serve communities. They're communities that might be very spread out, where it's hard to have a pipe system. They might not have a suitable water source or suitable land for construction. So not only are they challenging, those things make them more expensive to serve.
And Lynn, before we go to a couple other questions, you mentioned pipe systems. Does the state offer alternative systems, composting toilet kind of systems, or some other alternatives to a high-maintenance operation pipe system?
Absolutely, and I'm about to touch on that.
Okay. Well, we have two questions here, one Representative Dick and then Representative Foster.
Yes, I'm curious as to when you decide, you know, to put a water facility one place or another, do you look down the road as to the future of that village? I know some villages are growing, some are holding their own, and some are actually they're fading. I have one in mind where I know there was a brand new, I think it was a $1.7 million Washateria, where the school closed the next year, and now the village doesn't even have, barely has the money to even buy the fuel for that. So, and the school closing was actually, it was pretty predictable. So my question is, to what extent do we look down the road as in terms of the population trend in the village? Because that village now has 17 people. So that was my question.
Right. Representative Dick, through the chair, you'll see on my slide there some of the key issues, and that is one of them for us. We do look, to answer both questions here, we do work directly with the community to evaluate different types of systems that the community has the capability to operate and maintain over time. But a community won't even receive funding at this point until we have evaluated the community's administrative infrastructure. We call it a capacity assessment to make sure that they have the administrative infrastructure to even manage the utility that we might want to put in their community. Mm-hmm. So we look at that. The community that doesn't meet those key indicators doesn't get their construction funding until they can bring that administrative capacity up. And that's to do things like run a billing system and collect bills for the sewer water system. We do look at the usability, if you will, of a facility or a type of facility in a community. So not every community that wants pipes is going to get pipes. It doesn't always work that way, but we do work very closely with the villages to select the system. And as much as possible, we try to serve the community that's there and the homes that are there. We do try to do a little bit of forecasting, but by and large, we're trying to serve the community that's there.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to particularly underscore the difference in needs versus funding, $648 million versus the $60 million it looks like that you received in funding, both federal and state, I assume, combination of both. So that would be one-tenth of the need that's out there. And the question I had was just wanted to get some clarification on the needs that's increasing over time. And you would, you know, I initially thought, well, if you put $60 million in this year, $60 million last year, $60 million the year before, it should be going down. It's going up, and I think you were touching on that. Is that because some communities may not want it now, but then down the road their community may vote that they do want that, or is that because that money can also be used to fix a system that's outdated, and so now you're seeing more of those communities that are fixing their systems?
Right, Representative Foster, through the chair. Simple math would tell you we would get there soon, but things that are at play include inflation. So when the cost of fuel spiked, construction costs in rural Alaska just skyrocketed for our construction projects. Population changes can affect what we're doing. But when we define those critical needs for a community, we're not trying to decide what type of system that community might need. We're just identifying that they have a need that is human health related. Many of the facilities are old, and as you heard Friday from Kristen Ryan on the drinking water side, there are a lot of new regulatory requirements for a drinking water system. So as we design and construct a new drinking water system in a community, it has to comply with all the new rules. So the cost of systems are going up because of that as well. So there are a lot of factors at play that are causing that gap to get wider, even if we had steady state funding.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Representative Herr.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good slide, Lynn. And of course, that funding has probably been, you know, hopefully been the same about over the last several years. I guess more of a question is used to be basically Village Safe Water was a one-stop shop. Now it's USDA and the consortium, and of course Village Safe Water works with both those agencies. Has that exacerbated the problem? Has it made it easier? An honest question, if you could.
Yeah, Representative Herron, through the chair, we have two different funding sources coming in and two organizations that work on the projects, DEC and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, kind of divvy up the work. And actually, I think it works pretty well. I don't think it's exacerbating the problem.
The USDA part of it, Mr. Chairman?
The source of the funding coming from two different agencies is really not difficult for us.
Thank you.
And Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Lynn, I understand that we still have a long way to go, but can you tell us, there's 100 villages yet that don't have it, and we're working on that, and of the 200 that we've already done, some of that needs to be redone, and I mean something like that to give us an idea at least we are making progress, even though the needs are greater. You know, I'd like to know the progress so that to see how many villages that still need help.
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair, we do have that data, and I can get that to the committee.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so I'll move on here to what we're doing to help the communities in our operations assistance program. We have established by regulation different classes of drinking water systems and different classes of wastewater systems based on the complexity of operating them. And then we've designed education and experience requirements to make sure that the people who are operating those systems have the right skill set to do so in a safe manner and to provide safe drinking water and safe sewage disposal. And part of that program includes training courses for operators. We develop and administer tests, and then we actually certify the operators. And then when those facilities have permits from us, those permits require that they use an operator who's certified at the correct level for that facility. So that's just a safety measure to make sure they're being operated by people at the right level. We also run a remote maintenance worker program. The RMWs, as we refer to them, are helping to develop the capacity of the rural Alaskans to operate their own facilities. And also, one big role they play is to help safeguard the investment we've made in rural Alaska by ensuring that the proper maintenance and operation of the facilities. We have 15 RMWs throughout the state. 13 of them are employees of 7 regional health corporations who receive grants from DEC to pay for those RMWs. 2 of them are DEC employees. And these are really the circuit riders who go around to the communities on a regular basis and provide what we call over-the-shoulder assistance to the operator. So they spend their day with the operator while they're working on the facility, while they're fine-tuning it and making sure they're operating it safely. And then these are also the people who go to the village when the pump breaks down, they need a new switch, the pipes freeze. And I can't help but call these guys the heroes of rural Alaska. These are the guys who go out there in 30 below weather and stay out there in 30 below weather until the pipes are thawed and the community has a water system again. So I just listed some of the communities that they've provided response to in the last month or two, and it's pretty impressive. Okay, moving on to the other half of the division, our water quality side of our division.
Lynn, before you go on, a couple of things. First of all, we were talking about the needs, and I guess on the website for Village Safe Water, there's the remaining needs are stated, but then there's a statement at the end that this assessment does not include the needs of 65 rural Alaska villages that are non-native. So would you, when you're responding to us about the needs, would you make sure that that is incorporated and we have a little more information on where those villages are and what they entail?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we can do that.
Thank you. Representative Foster, yeah, I know Village Safe Water is a lot of concern here, so we'll take just a few more minutes on this.
Sure.
Representative Foster.
And actually, this one was with regard to the remote worker, and you were recognizing the heroes there, and I assume some of them had gone out to Savonga after the power outage that occurred last month to help with the disaster there.
Representative Foster, through the chair, I don't know if the RMWs actually went to Savonga or provided assistance remotely. They do both.
Okay.
And I could check on that if you'd like to know.
Okay. My sense is that they probably didn't. I just wanted to thank you for that. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
I guess I have a have a question about the 65 rural Alaskan villages that are non-native. Do you give grants and loans to the non-native villages also, or is it limited to the native ones?
The Village Safe Water, let me back up here real quickly. For the eligible communities are not necessarily native versus non-native. So this is the list of communities that are eligible. So it's unincorporated, the smaller unincorporated second-class cities and those that have fewer than first-class cities with fewer than 600.
Okay. And Lynn, one further thing on Village Safe Water. A few years ago, there was an audit. There was some problems with the management of grants and all. Has that all been resolved? Does the department feel that there's any, or the division feel that there's any further need to look at those, or has the effectiveness of that oversight resolved everything?
Yeah, Representative Seaton, the recent audits of the Village Safe Water Program have found no exceptions. I think we've made some pretty good improvements there in our procedures.
Good. Okay,
in
thank
good
you.
Shape. Okay, the other half of the division, the water quality side, we have five main programs: water quality standards, assessment and restoration, wastewater discharge permitting, compliance and enforcement, a cruise ship regulatory program, and water quality monitoring. Our core services, we establish protective standards. You heard the commissioner in the department overview talk about setting standards for air, land, and water. This is the water portion of those standards. We identify and restore polluted waters. We issue wastewater discharge permits to facilities that discharge contaminants. We have a facility compliance, ensure facility compliance with permits. We provide some community assistance for water quality protection. And then we monitor water quality and provide public access to that data.
Lynn, question on that. There has been a number of issues revolving around the copper standard. And I know that I believe the division was going under a reassessment. Can you bring us up to date on where we are in the investigation of the adequacy of our copper standard for aquatic life?
I would be happy to do that. with the permission of the chair, I might give a little background into water quality standards first.
Sure.
And then so you can see where the copper standard fits in. When we do set standards for water quality, this is done via regulation. The water quality standards really consist of two main parts: designated uses for those. So those are the types of uses of water that we protect water for, like water supply. So we protect it for drinking water. We protect it as a source for seafood processing and other industrial uses. We protect water for those hardy souls who want to swim in it, and for non-contact recreation like wading and fishing. And of course, we protect water for aquatic life, fish and other wildlife. The standards are set by regulation. They apply to the water body. So they apply to the lake, the river, the stream, the ocean. And they're really measures of how clean water has to be to protect those uses. The second part of the standards are the criteria. So for each of the uses and for each contaminant, we set a level that is safe for that use. So you'll see numeric criteria in our standards for instance, for copper, for protection of aquatic life, for protection of human health, and they may be different numbers. Sometimes humans are more sensitive, sometimes fish are more sensitive, but we set it for both uses of the water. And then we also have narrative criteria, and I've got an example up there where it's not real quantifiable. You have set a narrative criteria for other kinds of attributes that aren't readily measured, like may not cause a visible sheen on the surface of the water. The water quality standards are adopted by DEC in regulation. They have to be approved by the Environmental Protection Agency before we can use them for Clean Water Act purposes. And they are used for helping us set permit limits, helping us identify when a water body might be polluted, and also helping us measure when we've cleaned up a water body and it's no longer considered impaired or polluted. So current issues, we're getting close to copper here. We have a couple water quality standards revisions in progress right now. We made some changes to our residue criteria, which are a narrative standard. And the public comment period on that just closed a couple weeks ago. We're working on reviewing the comments and working towards final adoption of those regulations. And then we also have pending some revisions that were made to our mixing zone regulations, which are also a part of the water quality standards. We made those changes in 2006. We're still awaiting EPA action on them. Unfortunately, it's not unusual for it to take quite a few years for EPA to approve some of the standards revisions.
And Lynn, do we have indications from the EPA as why those haven't been approved?
Representative Seaton, the water quality standards review and approval process for EPA now is getting more and more complex. They have consultation requirements with the services, with Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA. So in part, they're dependent upon third-party agencies to review their work on approving our work. That's part of it. They've had a few resource issues, but they have told me that they have staff assigned to this now and are working on it. So we're hoping to hear back from them soon.
Thank you. We have Representative Kowalski and then Heron.
Just a real quick question on the water quality standards. Are there any water quality standards adopted by DEC that are higher than the minimum set by EPA currently?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, almost all of our standards are identical to the ones set by EPA, and the reason for that is in order to set a water quality standard, there is a whole host of laboratory studies that need to be done, and we're not really funded to do that kind of work. So most of our standards are based on the EPA standards. We have a couple that are probably more stringent. Petroleum is one that comes to mind.
And Lynn, on primacy, wasn't one of the issues that we are required to have water quality standards at least as strict as the federal requirements?
Yes, Representative Seaton, we're required to do that separate and apart from the primacy for the permitting program. So the Clean Water Act requires our standards to be at least as stringent as EPA's.
Okay, thank you. Representative Heron and Munoz?
Briefly, essentially it's a follow-up from the chairman is Lynn. I mean, you know, our quality standards are approved by the EPA. Is it a top-down? You don't get to have an intelligent conversation with them? Do you ever get to push back and say you don't know what you're talking about?
Representative Heron, through the chair, we've been pretty adamant in working with EPA and trying to move them along. This long period of time for review and approval of water quality standards is not limited just to Region 10 of EPA. I hear states across the country have challenges with EPA getting through that review and approval process in a timely manner. And yes, it's very frustrating.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. With legislation that would change a water quality standard, would the same requirements for the process before EPA be the same, or would it happen after the legislation? How could you speak to that?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the way it works right now is that the state adopts a change in regulation, and it actually has to be adopted by the state before we can submit it to EPA for review and approval. I'm not aware of other states where the legislature has set water quality standards. We would certainly have to look at what that process is if there is a statute established for a water quality standard. I presume that it would also have to go through some sort of review and approval process with EPA. It just might look a little bit different than when it's a state regulation.
Thank
Great.
Okay. So where was I? Planned updates. The Clean Water Act requires the state to look at all of our water quality standards every 3 years. They call it the triennial review. And that starts off with a public notice that is does not tell the public we're changing anything, but it invites the public to let us know if there's new science or new information that might cause us to look at a particular standard and evaluate whether or not it needs to be changed. So the start of that triennial review is coming right up, and it will be kind of a broad public notice that doesn't, again, propose any changes at that point in time. But we're always kind of looking at our standards and working on what we might need to change in any given triennial review period. And there are a couple things that we're thinking we will need to be doing over this next three-year period, and one of them has to do with anti-degradation. That's a kind of a code term for Clean Water Act requirement that states may not allow degradation of water quality except under some very narrow circumstances. So DEC has adopted in regulation our own anti-degradation policy that mirrors the federal policy. We have also adopted interim procedures on how we will implement that anti-degradation policy. But we're, at this point, planning during this next triennial review to develop more robust implementation procedures for how we will implement that policy in permitting and in other DEC actions. And then the next one listed here, copper. Thank you for your patience, Chairman. There's been an awful lot of interest in copper due to mines and planned mines. The copper criteria that we have right now is based upon EPA's copper standards. There was a lot of interest in this in a previous triennial review, so we did actually do a full scientific literature review on copper to see what kinds of scientific information might be out there that would cause us to change our copper criteria, either up or down. We did that in 2004. And what we learned with that review is, in particular looking at salmon, which we're all concerned about, was that there are no lethality effects and no growth effects on salmon due to copper that's at or below the current standards that we have on the books. So at that point in time, we didn't make any changes to the copper criteria.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your studies, what did you... There's also collateral elements that are always around copper. Did that include those elements as well, or is strictly just copper?
Representative Heron, through the chair, I believe we were just looking at copper. We have learned that there are things that affect copper toxicity, like dissolved organic copper. I mean, dissolved organic carbon, can't speak here, that may have an effect on the toxicity, and we'll be looking into that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, DEC sponsored a copper session at the Alaska Forum on the Environment last year, again, trying to share what we know about copper and to see if we could find other information on copper. And it's highly likely that we will do another review on copper through this next triennial review just because of the level of interest and because of some recent studies that show some behavioral effects on salmon at pretty low concentrations of copper.
And Representative Feige.
Representative Heron sort of alluded to it, but are there other elements that and minerals, I guess, that present problems in specifically in Alaska that cause conflict with the EPA regs? In other words, are there just naturally occurring compounds that cause us to have problems meeting certain EPA standards?
Yes, Representative Feige, through the chair. There are natural conditions in some of our water bodies where the natural condition of a substance may be above our water quality standard. We also have a reg that allows that to kind of be the prevailing standard if it truly is a natural condition. Yeah. We don't try to regulate Mother Nature.
Does the EPA?
Okay.
Lynn, before we go on, the behavioral effects, can you kind of describe those for us as what we're talking about? We're talking about predation avoidance and homing instinct and that kind of thing. Is that correct?
Right. Representative Seaton, we did have a presentation on some studies that have been done in the Pacific Northwest about behavioral response to copper and whether or not salmon will avoid a predator in the presence of copper, and there's a reduced response there, which would, of course, make them more susceptible to predation.
And so that is, so you're following up on that with requesting other studies to look at that as far as for our copper standard for salmon-bearing rivers. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, Chair Seaton. What we will likely do is review any new literature that's available. DEC probably won't be funding its own independent studies on that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner, did you have a question? No. Okay, thank you.
Okay, how are we doing on time here? We're good.
15 minutes.
Okay. Next program is our wastewater discharge permitting program. Any discharge of liquid or solid waste to the land, to the water, or to the subsurface requires a permit from DEC in some way, shape, or form. Permittees for wastewater discharge permits include all of the major industries here in Alaska, the timber industry, large mines, placer mines, oil and gas facilities, seafood processing, construction sites, and you might wonder about that one, but when you have a large land disturbance, you may have runoff from those construction sites that can cause sediment problems in nearby waterways. And then domestic sewage treatment.
Yeah, and Representative Kawasaki?
Are there any permits, Lynn, for coal ash uses backfill currently, specifically dealing with the water tables and potential contamination?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I believe that's regulated by the Solid Waste Program, and their regulation is designed to protect water as well.
Thank you.
Okay, moving along here. Discharges to waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act, that's surface waters, lakes, rivers, streams, the ocean. Those discharges require a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. That's a mouthful, or NPDES permit. But Alaska, like 46 other states, has taken on primacy or authority to implement a permitting program that mirrors the NPDES program. We call it the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Program, also a mouthful, or APDES. And we have been working on this for many years, but actually taking over the permitting program in phases based on the type of industrial or domestic discharge. So we have now phases 1, 2, and 3 have been transferred over to the state. Whoops. There we go. So that's domestic wastewater, timber, seafood, federal facilities, stormwater, domestic pretreatment, and mining. And then the final phase is primarily oil and gas and then a few others. EPA does retain responsibility for a few small groups of permits in the state and always will because the Clean Water Act requires them to retain certain permittees. The permits.
And Lynn, how is our workforce doing as far as the number of people working on these permits versus prior? And what is our kind of time frame now that we have on turnaround on permits?
Representative Seaton, the staffing for our program is more robust than the staffing program that EPA had when they were running the permitting program. But we are on a learning curve. So we're issuing permits as quickly as EPA was issuing them, but we want to issue them a lot faster. I have a slide here on some data there coming up here in a moment. I'll just quickly touch on this slide, and then we'll move to the data on permits.
Recording stopped.
We'll take a brief at ease.
You guys are fine. That was another LIO.
Okay.
Well,
I won't. On the record.
Thank you. I won't go through this slide in any detail, but we do have a very transparent process for the public to see what we're doing from start to finish on our permits, and it's more inclusive than.
Recording started.
Than the program EPA was running. Okay, here's data for 2010 for permitting. We've issued 637 general permit authorizations. We still have to certify permits that are issued by EPA that they comply with our water quality standards. We've issued 3 APDES permits this year. And then because we're in this big ramp-up mode to issue permits, we actually have 25 of them in various stages of development or near finishing, near completion. 12 of them that are under development or close to the internal review stage. five out for public review, five where public comments completed and we're working on the final permits, and then we have we're working on three certifications of EPA permits. So we're increasing our speed and capability there. Okay, like all major environmental laws, the clean water laws are in part dependent upon permittees self-monitoring and reporting to us. We review that monitoring data that they send to us. We inspect facilities. We take our own samples sometimes. And where necessary, we take enforcement actions.
And Lynn, is that data now being reported on your webpage?
Representative Seaton, do you mean for the permitting or for the compliance work?
The compliance work, or the so that the public can see the discharges and the amounts that are actually going into our water bodies.
Representative Seaton, the discharge monitoring reports that are self-reported by the facilities are available on a public public website.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, our inspection goals follow EPA's inspection goals for the country. We look at major facilities once every 2 years, what we refer to as non-majors once during the permit cycle, which is every 5 years, and then stormwater facilities, we try to hit 5 to 10% of those each year based on the size of the construction sites. And then, of course, we do complaint-driven inspections. Our goal for last year was 120 inspections, and we actually did 140 for a variety of types of facilities, a couple joint inspections with EPA. We issued 22 notices of violation, and we did one compliance order by consent last year. And again, we look at all types of facilities, the large mines, the little mines, the seafood processors, stormwater, domestic wastewater. Okay, we also have a cruise ship regulatory program, the first in the country, may still be the only, although other states are looking at them. We had 28 cruise ships registered to visit Alaska in 2010. And I will start with an overview here of the Ocean Ranger program. This is the only program like this in the country. Vessels that are entering Alaskan waters are required to have an Ocean Ranger on board, and their job is to observe compliance with both state and federal health, safety, and environmental rules. They were established by state law in 2006. They're funded with a $4 per head passenger fee, and that brings in somewhere between $3.6 and $4 million each year, depending on the number of passengers in any given year. In 2010, we were able to have an Ocean Ranger on board 90% of the vessels for their entire voyage in Alaska. And then the other vessels were either visited by Ocean Rangers or DEC while they were in port. We get about almost 2,000 daily reports from the Ocean Rangers. And then there are some in the legislature who have had a very keen interest in how many of the Ocean Rangers are Alaskans. And each year it creeps up a tiny bit. We had five of the 21 Ocean Rangers last year were Alaskans, and we've been working with the Department of Labor, their workforce development group, to see what we can do about more training opportunities for potential future Ocean Rangers that are residents here.
Okay, and Representative Munoz has a question.
Thank you. On that subject, what are the training requirements for the Ocean Rangers?
Representative Munoz, the chair, Ocean Rangers have to be a Coast Guard licensed marine engineer or have a degree from a maritime academy. And the marine engineer requirements include sea time, so it's a challenge for us to find Alaskans who want a part-time or a seasonal job doing this work.
Representative Wills.
Zeroing in on the Ocean Rangers here, there are two marine groups across the nation, and the one is based nationwide, and one is more Alaska oriented. And why we use the nationwide one instead of the Alaska oriented one is beyond me. Can you tell me why we do that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we contract out management of the Ocean Ranger program, and so the contractors who bid on that contract have an opportunity to work with one or the other of the marine unions. I don't know that we would have better Alaskan higher rates by using the Alaska Union over the other one. Again, because the training requirements and the nature of this job being a seasonal job, there just aren't a lot of people who are interested in that kind of short-term work when most of them are working year-round.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
Well, from what I could gather, because I did a little research into this, and from what I could gather, even the people that are in charge of the Alaska Ocean Rangers, most of that is even though they have a presence in Anchorage, the Ocean Ranger part is taken care of in another state in the lower 48. And why we picked the same group when there were other alternatives is something that we should definitely look into the next time that comes around. I know we just did it, and we're maybe in the process of still doing it. Yeah, but I just don't really like the fact that the ones that we had didn't have a real presence for that division for the Ocean Rangers in Alaska when we're concerned about it in Alaska. And I think that we should insist on that the next time. I mean, they have a presence in Anchorage, but that's a different division. And I think we need to look into that a little bit more, maybe as legislators.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And have we gotten over the problem where the contractor was not accepting the Alaska engineering licenses and were only... We had a problem in which the Louisiana outfit was only accepting licenses that were unlimited, and those that are mainly used in Alaska are tug engineers, and they weren't accepting that license. And so I appreciate you just getting back to us on that as to whether that has been solved.
I can do that.
And we don't have very much time, so let's go on and we'll
quickly go through these. We also, it's one of the the only air thing we do in the water division is to do the opacity readings for cruise ships, and we do that using our own certified readers as well as contractors. That's a kind of a standard part of the regulatory program, same as other air emissions.
And the science advisory panel, are you convening that again, or when's the next panel meeting, and is that all reset?
Well, the science advisory panel was set up by the legislature to help us look at the technologies for wastewater discharge from cruise ships. They met three times during 2010. This is a group of worldwide experts. It's very exciting to be in the room with six different English as a second language people who are real experts in shipbuilding, ship design, wastewater treatment design. They, like I said, they've met three times. I think that their next meeting, Representative Seaton, is a teleconference coming up in the next week or two. So normally they have a full face-to-face meeting, or have had three of those so far.
Okay, and if that's available for a listen-in by the legislature, I think there's people who would like to know about that, so if you'd send that to us. And also one of the questions that has come up was the requirement for best available technology, and there's a question that isn't being applied across the cruise ships, but it's if we've decided on best available technology for one ship and then we're not applying that to the others, we're saying, well, if yours is good enough. And this is a question that's come to me. I'm not really familiar with that subject, but would you quickly explain that to us?
I can elaborate on that. It will take me more than a minute. The cruise ships have, by statute, a higher goal or a higher threshold for their wastewater discharge permit. So most wastewater discharges in Alaska are allowed an opportunity via permitting to have a permitted mixing zone where what they discharge after treatment that can't quite get them down to the water quality standards allows them to discharge something that has contaminants that are a little bit above the water quality standards, knowing that in the mixing zone it will dilute with the surface water, and at the edge of that mixing zone all of the standards will be met and water, all the designated uses will be protected. For cruise ships are required or are under law headed towards requiring them to meet the water quality standards at the point of discharge. So what comes out of the pipe has to be swimmable. I was going to say drinkable, but that's not true for salt water, but has to meet all the water quality standards at the point of discharge. The vessels that discharge in Alaska are meeting all of the water quality standards at the point of discharge, except for four substances, ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. And the science advisory panel was set up to look at new technologies, emerging technologies, that will allow them to get the last little bit of those four contaminants out of the wastewater before they discharge in Alaska. They're not quite there yet, so the permit does allow them to discharge those contaminants at a little bit above the water quality standards. Is that
answer
your question?
I guess what I'm trying to find out is, my understanding was there were systems that were approved and that are in place on some vessels that meet those standards, but that those systems or those modifications aren't being required of the others, even though that's now proven best technology, and I thought that that was a requirement of the statute.
Representative Seaton, the all of the vessels that are operating or that are discharging in Alaska have what are called these advanced wastewater treatment systems. And if you look carefully at the data on those systems, some do better than others for those four substances, and other systems do better for others of the four substances. So there's no one system that can consistently meet the water quality standards for all of those four substances. They also take into their wastewater treatment system different waste streams and discharge different waste streams. So it's very difficult. You have to look very carefully at the data. A vessel with a certain kind of treatment system that looks like it might be meeting all the standards may only be treating gray water and not both gray water and black water. So the panel is helping us look at that data. But right now there's no clear answer that any one system is the perfect system over all the others.
Okay, thank you. Reverend Gardner.
Thank you. If we have to meet or exceed federal standards, are federal standards related to the point of discharge or the mixing zone?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the federal standards relate to the water body itself. So
there's wiggle room.
There's we use those standards to set the limits in a permit, but a permit will often allow a discharge that's a little bit above those standards because we know there'll be dilution and there really won't be a negative impact on the water body as a whole.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Covered permitting, sort of covered the panel. We have a very small non-point source program. Non-point source, think of that as something that doesn't come out of a pipe that can get into a water body, so animal waste runoff from a park or fertilizers from yards, that sort of thing. We work with communities to try to avoid those problems because non-point source problems are what are causing polluted waters today. It's really not permitted facilities anymore. As a nation, we've got a pretty good handle on those. Part of the program is small grants to help us meet state priorities for water quality. We go out, we do some outreach. How are we doing on time, Representative Seaton?
We just got a couple minutes.
7 seconds here. We monitor water quality, flipping through. We report to the public on what we learn when we monitor water quality. You can find those reports on our website. We have half the nation's waters, but we don't get half the nation's budget for water quality monitoring. I wish we did, but we have to kind of work our way around the state slowly to get baseline data for Alaska. And I know that's a busy map, but basically the take home there is that we are collecting baseline data as funding is available, and we do that with other partners. All of our data has specific objectives. It's done under a quality assurance plan so that we can rely on the data, and it's reported on our website. And then we also do a biannual report on the health of Alaska's water. So we tell the public what's polluted, what's recovering, and what has recovered. And the 2010 report is available on the web, too. And there.
And thank you. And we are out of time. I want to compliment both divisions on an excellent and thorough presentation. We'll appreciate getting those answers to those further questions. And if any member has a detailed question for either Division of Water or Spill Prevention Response, I presume you'll be here for the next few minutes, and with that, we'll be adjourned at 3:05.